obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
We called the old timers meeting, but we were offended, so now it's just long timers. The Saturday Long Timers panel of the 30th Annual Orange County Alcoholics Anonymous Convention. I told you my name is Carol and I'm alcoholic, and I'd like you to join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now today our panelists, all three of them, are going to be reading Chapter 3, Chapter 5, and the traditions. And following their reading, they're going to be sharing with us for 15 or 20 minutes. If they go over, don't boo them off the podium. It hurts their feelings. Okay? And this is the anonymity statement. There are maybe some here who are not familiar with the tradition of personal anonymity at the public level. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need to always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films, and television. Therefore, we respectfully ask that no AA speaker or any AA member be identified by full name or photographs and published or broadcast reports of our meetings. And out of respect for our panelists, would we please turn off your cell phones and pagers or put them in vibrate? Thank you. The preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, and does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Our first panelist speaker is Diane G. from Huntington Beach.
I'm chapter three?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Hi, I'm Diane. I'm an alcoholic.
Diane.
More about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control. But such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, Many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule. Therefore, non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase this list ad infinitum. Yay. So, I've told you, I'm Diane, I'm an alcoholic.
Diane.
I got sober April 4th, 1973.
Hey, happy birthday.
Thank you. Don't sing to me, Patty. I'm really, really glad to be here today. When Carol called me and invited me, I was just excited. I got sober in 1973, sometime between March 31st and April 5th. So I picked the 4th because I could remember it. 4-4. Don't give me too much in the beginning. It was very hard. So that is my sobriety date. And I have been so fortunate to be blessed with the finest members in Alcoholics Anonymous sharing my journey. I have been so lucky. I got sober in a group of old-timers. They were old. And they were long-timers. They had some sobriety. And I, however, wasn't really an alcoholic when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, which was when I was 18. I was 18, and the people around me were telling me I should think about doing something about my drinking. I didn't think I should do something about my drinking, but they did. So they recommended AA, and I went. I went. They were wrong. No, seriously, you guys were old. The speaker that I heard when I was 18 was Chuck C. Hey, yeah, he was 18 years sober. I was barely 18 years old. Come on. There's got to be another way, right? There has to be another way. So I kept changing things up. You know, I would drink different things. I would add little things to what I drank so I could last longer and not get in so much trouble. I started getting arrested when I was very young. I hung out with the Hessians and the Devil's Disciples. They were really nice guys. I'm not kidding. They were really nice guys. But when they got in a group and had parties, they weren't so nice. And if you passed out at their party, which I often did, they would wake you up with lighter fluid and a match. Not my idea of a good time. So I decided to take little things that helped you last the whole party. And then sometimes you would last way longer than they wanted you around, so you would take other things. And one of the things I know about my alcoholism is when I stopped drinking, when I came to AA and I stopped drinking, I don't do those other things. They're not part of my life. They're not part of my recovery. I am an alcoholic, and I cannot drink like other men and women, and I never will be able to. And it isn't going to help me to add those little things, because then I'm going to drink. So I just know who I am. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the biggest problem I had was lying. And I'm sure none of you understand. I mean, I know a lot of honest people, but I lied. I sat in the meetings and I heard a really cool story. And then the next time I talked to somebody, my story. Somebody had been deported from Mexico. I thought, how cool. And I'm not even sure I had been to Mexico yet, but I talked to a friend and I had been deported from Mexico. It was so cool. And the reason I discovered that I did these things was because I was so inadequate. I was never enough, no matter what I did. Not pretty enough, smart enough, funny, nothing enough. And so when I would acquire these attributes, even though they weren't mine, they made me feel like I was enough. I was a surfer for the longest time. I had a great surfboard, really pretty. I waxed the hell out of that thing. And I never went in the ocean because I'm afraid of sharks. They scare me. And I know that with my luck, I would be the target. So I gave that up. People used to ask me, what nationality are you? American Indian. Can you not tell? Cheekbones? American Indian. Have the hair? My friend Norm came up to me in a meeting one night and he said, hey, Diane, come with me and let's do some work with our people. They really need our help. I had been here just long enough to understand that I had to tell him, Norm, I'm Czechoslovakian. I know. And I'm telling you, no matter how long I tell this story, it is so hard. I want to be an American Indian. I do, but I'm not. And one of the things you have allowed me to do over the years in Alcoholics Anonymous is become enough just where I stand. I am enough. I am Czechoslovakian. I'm not a surfer. And I've never been deported from Mexico. However, I got sober with people who believed in being of service. They believed in picking up after yourself, picking up after the meeting, moving the chairs, going to H&I, hanging out in general service, and figuring out what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. Before I could do that, I met somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've probably heard this story as many times as you've heard speakers speak, but I met a guy, God's will for me. You know, people say things like, I got this extra check in the mail, God's will for me. I got a new car, God's will for me. So I met this guy, God's will for me. We both were sober 10 months. We both played guitar. We knew that we were meant to be together. So he explained to his wife. Oh, yeah. I know. You're a lot kinder than they were at the time. The Al-Anons hated me. He explained to his wife what had happened, and God's will, and I got married to live happily ever after. And you know how much better weddings are than marriage? Really, seriously, I am so good at weddings. I love them. Love the party, love the fun, love the camaraderie. I suck at marriage. I just don't do it well. So God's will and I were married for a while and decided that it wasn't working. So he went to practice his principles in other affairs and moved away. And I was left to figure out Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when I started getting busy. I had a friend who was involved in general service. He was the delegate at the time. And he took me to general service meetings, and they were fighting over stuff, like a word in the bylaws. Who cares? I mean, seriously, who cares? And I stayed long enough to figure out that that is basically the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's where the book is published. It's where the traditions are upheld. They are the keeper of the traditions. And to me, the traditions are the most phenomenal piece of writing in Alcoholics Anonymous. It has kept people like us together in one place for 80 years. Can you believe that? I don't know who you are, not all of you. I know some of you, and just those, and knowing who I am. It is phenomenal that we still exist after all these years, because everything about me was self-serving. Everything about me. And I have learned here that the only time I'm at peace with myself is when I'm being of service to you. So I got involved in general service, and I stayed busy there. And they elected me, they wanted me to run for office at the assembly level. They wanted me to stand for a position. I said, absolutely, I'll do it. Anything but secretary. Please, no secretary. I got elected secretary on the first ballot. And what I learned from that position is how to listen. Do you know when you're secretary, you have to take minutes? So you actually have to listen to what people are saying. You cannot continually have conversations in your head about what they're wearing or what they're saying or who they're dating. You have to shut that up and pay attention to what they're saying. And I learned amazing things as Secretary of General Service. And the next time they had elections, I said, sure, I can't be secretary again, so yeah. And I was elected delegate. And I was allowed to go to New York and serve this area for 2 years as your delegate in 1982 and 83. And the thing I loved about that is I was there about, I don't know, probably 6 hours. And I realized that I was out of my element, that pretty soon they would discover that I didn't fit in, I didn't belong there, I wasn't good enough. I was only 9 years sober. I was 34 years old. I was young. And they all knew stuff, and I didn't know it. So I told my friend George, George, you got to send me home. Seriously, you got to send me home because they're going to impeach me. I don't know enough about this. I'm not going to do a good job. They deserve better than that. And he said, you know what, Diane? You got to quit worrying about how you feel. And do the job you were given to do because it needs to get done. In 5 years, nobody's going to remember your delegate anyway. And sad as that is, that's the truth, because half of my friends never knew what a delegate was. They just thought I traveled a lot. So what I know about jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous is if somebody asks me to do something, whether I think I can do it or not, if I have the time available, I do it. It doesn't matter how well I do it or how long I do it. What matters is I do it, because I have no clue what I need. I have no clue. My life has changed so incredibly from the angry, self-centered, frightened person I was when I got here. I want to just tell you a little story about the last 3 years, and I'll sit down. I got a job, one of my first, when I got sober, because they said I needed to. And I got this job doing typesetting. Probably most of you young people will not know what that is, but it was the way newspapers were printed and things, printed material happened. And from that job, the guy who owned the typesetting company hired me to do managing editing for racing magazines. I loved that job. I didn't know anything about racing, yeah. Auto racing. I didn't really care much about it, but I loved that job. I love words, and I was really good at it. And I was managing editor for Racer magazine for 28 years. And I just thought I would do it till I died. You know, and a few years ago, publishing kind of tanked. And they weren't having very good years. And they had to decide how to cut some corners. So they eliminated some positions. And one of them was mine. And I had no idea what I was going to do because, as you know, I'm quite old. And I was 64 at the time. And I didn't know what I was going to do. Not ready for Social Security yet. Got to work. Made some mistakes early. Need to pay bills. So I did what I learned how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to meetings. I talked about it. I looked for a job every day. Every day I went online, I looked for a job. I went to every seminar they offered at the one-stop center. I did everything possible. And I learned that it'll be who you know and not what you know. It won't be your resume. It'll be who knows you. So I just kept doing it. One day I'm in a meeting and my friend said, I need a receptionist. He hired me. Oh, cool, dog. He hired me to be his receptionist part-time, and I ended up being the human resources person for that company because they didn't have one and they needed one. Nobody likes human resources. Can I just tell you that? The job is hard. You have to be for the company and the employee. Not really easy. So, but I would have stayed there forever because that's what I do. And right after I lost my job at the magazines, somebody killed my car. I was in an accident. Somebody hit it and totaled it. So I had no car, and I'm looking for a job. And somebody said, my mother-in-law has a car in her garage. She never drives it. They were going to give it to the grandkids, but the grandkids said, for old people. They gave me the car. So I have a little blue Chevy. Love that car. I've had it forever and for 3 years now. Then I got laid off from my HR job, which I would have kept till I died. And I had no idea what I was going to do, but I needed to work. However, I was collecting Social Security at the time, so it was a little easier. And I applied for jobs online. I did everything you taught me to do. I talked about it. I let people know what I was looking for. And all of a sudden, a friend of mine in a meeting said, you're in the top two at the city of Huntington Beach, but you probably won't get hired because the other one is a friend of my boss. I said, geez, it's great to be in the top two. And I kept looking for a job. Well, I got that job. And I still have that job. It was supposed to be temporary. It's permanent. And what I want to tell you is I love working at the city of Huntington Beach. I work in the city clerk's office. It's one of the nicest offices I've ever worked in. And my life is nothing that I would have chosen for myself. I would have had a completely different look, and I would have cheated myself terribly because I have never been happier or more at peace. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And our next speaker is Pat Y. from Palm Desert.
Hi, everybody. My name is Pat Yeo, and I'm an alcoholic. Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Okay, so I'm Pat. I'm an alcoholic. We're all within a couple of years of sobriety of each other, and we were talking earlier. When we were new, the old-timers seemed really old. I mean, like chronologically old. We feel like really young. Maybe if you're young sitting in the room, you're thinking, you don't look so young to me, but we feel young, so... Anyway, thank you, Diane. You made me think of so many things. I started drinking when I was 13. I drank that night because I was at a party and I wanted people to like me, and so I drank, and the magic happened, which is it changed how I felt about everything. I relaxed and I danced and I was fun or I felt fun. I don't know if I was fun, but I felt fun, and it was great. It was really great. I drank too much, and I blacked out, and I passed out, and I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know. A little bit more than I meant to do that night, and I felt bad the next day. You know, I felt embarrassed and ashamed and terrified I'd get pregnant, and imagine the bad feelings, you know, you'd have, and I had all those bad feelings. But I drank again at the very next opportunity, and that basically, you know, that night really, that's how it went for me. When I drink, as I like to describe it, I get friendly. And so I developed this reputation in high school for being a friendly girl, and you know, that's not really how I wanted people to think about me. And I meant to grow up and get married and stay married to the same person forever, but I'm 13, 14, 15 years old, and I kind of know already it's not happening for me, and it didn't happen for me quite that way. I did get married when I was 18 because he asked. And divorced at 18 and a half because it was a mistake. Actually, it was my mistake. Well, it was his mistake, too. He deserved a lot better than he got. You know, in retrospect, I can see that I was, as the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I needed a drink. We drank a little bit, but we were a young married couple with not really much money at all, and so we couldn't afford to drink much, and I needed to drink a lot more than we were drinking, and I couldn't have told you that then. But it's very clear to me today. So I grew up in Newport Beach. I left him, and I moved up to L.A. and got a job, an apartment. I was 18, maybe 19 years old, and I had an ID that said I was 35 or something. And I started getting drunk. I was working as a secretary, and I'm getting drunk every night. And I met the man who was to become my second husband in a bar where I was working as a go-go dancer. I just said I was working as a secretary, didn't I? I was kind of multitasking, I guess. This guy was the most inappropriate man in the state of California for me, so
of course, we moved right in together and did get married. And now I'm married again, but I'm a full-blown alcoholic now. And although I'm married, I'm still acting like I'm single, you know. And we had a lot of trouble in that marriage, as you might imagine. And all caused by my behavior, all of it caused by my behavior behind drinking. And, you know, I started getting arrested. And, you know, it's just it's a bad story, you know. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. When I drink, bad things happen to me. I spent the last few years, I don't know how long, I was in blackouts a lot. I have very hazy time frame. I love speakers who say, and then in 1962, I think it was a Thursday. I don't know, you know. Sometime in there, I started drinking at home. You know, when I drank at home, you don't get arrested when you're drunk in your living room in a purple flannel bathrobe. You hardly ever cheat on your husband when you're there, although it can happen and did, but just not as frequently. My husband was a gambler, so he was gone a lot at night at the racetrack and poker games or wherever gamblers go. And that, by now I just preferred it when he was gone. It was, I could just drink and not try to make it look different than what it was. And it was drinking to pass out. That's all I'm doing. And I turned into one of those pathetic people who call other people on the phone, you know, nodding heads. My own personal favorite was a boyfriend I had when I was 12. Of course, I have no idea where he might be living now. So, and if you're a phone caller or if you're an Al-Anon and got the calls, you know that this never happens at 7:30 in the evening. You know, it's always 2 or 3 in the morning. And I have no idea where this former boyfriend might live now. So I wake up a number of other people, and I found him. And pretty sure he and his wife were really happy to hear from me. Maybe not. Never did call back. Anyway, you kind of get the idea. You know, my life was a mess. It was just a mess. I was working a little tiny job at the end, and, you know, all the talent or whatever that I had was, you know, had long been drunk away, and I was just hanging on to this little job kind of by the skin of my teeth. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous one night, and I came to AA with not any idea that my life was going to change, but not having a better idea, thank God. Thank God I didn't have a better idea. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my first meeting was in Santa Monica in the basement of a church. It was a big speaker meeting, maybe 300, 350 people maybe, and it might as well have been 30,000 people. You know, I'm like stark raving sober, and I saw you going, you know how we are, hugging and kissing and going down these steps into the basement there, and I thought, there is no way I can get out of this car and go in that door, but I did. And there was a man standing at the door who put out his hand and said, "Hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." It made me feel welcome. You know, I think it's the single most important thing anybody ever does in a meeting. I went in the room and you know, all these people are milling around. It was 8:30 meeting, so I got there at 8:29, you know. And I found a seat, and this man came out of the crowd and asked me if I was new. I couldn't imagine how he knew that. Said that I was, and he got me a big book and a seat. It was a speaker meeting. Norm Alpe spoke that night, and I heard him. You know, I remember a couple of things from that night very clearly. One is I was sitting way in the back of this big room, and I remember he talked really fast, and I was leaning forward in my seat so I wouldn't miss anything that he said, and I became like aware of that, like, wow, I'm really in the room, so to speak, you know what I mean? And then the other thing was he said something really funny that made me laugh, and I couldn't remember ever having laughed that hard. And of course, I was laughing laughter of identification. You know, I didn't know that, any of that then, but it's clear today. Anyway, I began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'd like to tell you that I got a sponsor right away, and I started doing what she said. I didn't do any of it happily. I cried all the time my first year because I thought I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came here. I fought with my husband all the time about Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to be clear here. We'd been fighting about for years, but we just have a new topic now, you know. I cheated on him all the years we'd been married, and now I'm in AA. I'm gone every night, and he thinks I'm coming here to meet men. Which, I have to say, I was not opposed to the idea of becoming better acquainted with some of you gentlemen. However, none of the men in AA appeared to be interested in me, which hurt my feelings quite a bit. And it really made me mad that my husband was accusing me of something I was not actually doing at that minute, you know? And so I felt really, really sorry for myself, but But I kept coming to meetings regardless. You know, I'd drive to every meeting crying, and I'd get to the meeting, and I'd feel a little better by the time it was over. And I had, Diane talked about commitments. I had commitments, and I hated all of them. You know, my sponsor told me to have early commitments, so I'd be at the meeting early and then do the commitment, whatever it was, you know, set up the chairs or whatever, and then circulate throughout the room until the meeting starts, shaking hands with people as they get there, introducing myself, asking how they are as though I care. And so, you know, I slam the cookies around in the kitchen or whatever my job is, and now I'm working the room, you know. Hi, Patty, how are you? And, of course, she'd say something like, fine, Pat, how are you? And I'd tell her how I was, you know, till her eyes would glaze over and move on to the next person. And I was just miserable, miserable. I think I learned the most important thing I've learned ever in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 3 months sober, maybe 4 months. I was doing just what I just described to you, working the room, as I like to say. And I went up to this guy, Larry, and asked him how he was, and he said, fine, and asked me, and I started to tell him, and he cut me off. He said, I don't want to listen to that. Why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? Perhaps you'd feel better. And he pointed to a girl in the back of the room. He said, that girl in the red dress is at her very first meeting. Why don't you just march over and say hello? I remembered thinking, clearly, like this was yesterday, thinking that I didn't care if the girl in the red dress lived or died. I wish Larry would die. But I knew if I didn't do it, he would tell my sponsor. So this shouldn't take but a moment. I'll go over and say hello. And so, if memory serves me correctly, I was crying when I welcomed this girl to Alcoholics Anonymous. The girl who had 12-stepped her, who I knew, said, oh, Pat, I'm so happy to see you. This is this girl's first meeting. And she had this big fight with her husband about coming to AA, and I've been waiting for you because I knew you were the exact right person to talk to her. I remember standing there thinking, I am the worst person in the room to talk to her. I fight with my husband every night about coming to AA. I have nothing good to share here. I kind of overlooked that I was sober. That was pretty good. But all I could see was how sad and tragic my life was. But at the same time, I'm thinking, this is like, you know, split-second thinking. At the same time I'm thinking that, I'm thinking, I'm standing in front of a girl at her first meeting. I should try to be positive here. And I opened up my mouth and I heard myself say, keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time. Now I've just lied to a newcomer. It's not getting better. Honestly, I don't think it's getting better at all. I turned and walked away. I know I didn't talk to this girl for more than 10 seconds. I was completely incapable. I remember there was a center aisle like this. I was walking back down that center aisle, and I had this moment, this spiritual experience. It was the first time in that 3-4 months, whatever it was, that I was sober, that I was at a meeting in that hour period of time from the time I hit the door of the meeting hall until the meeting actually starts, that I was there and I wasn't crying. And the reason I wasn't crying is for that brief little moment I thought about somebody else besides myself. It turns out when I'm thinking about you, I can't be thinking about me at the same time. So I'd like to go from here and just tell you how spiritual my journey has been, but you talked about lies, which just, I can't get it out of my head now. I haven't told this story very often. I was about, 10, 12, please God, not 15 years sober, but longer sober than I care to admit. I was speaking at a meeting, at the Under the Bridge meeting in Long Beach, where you talk on, you know, steps or traditions, and I was talking about the eighth and ninth step, and they do question and answers there, and somebody asked the question, have you ever stolen from, like, a store, you know, like a department store or something? I said, well, yes, as a matter of fact, I have. One of my very first jobs when I was a teenager was working for JCPenney Company in the credit and layaway department and gift wrap. And you would come in and, you know, put money on your layaway thing or get a gift wrapped or whatever. So there was a lot of cash that crossed that desk. And I helped myself to some of it. So I'm telling this story from the podium, and then the guy says, well, how'd you pay it back? I said, well, I just wrote a check and sent it to the store. Now, that whole story is true, except the last part. I had never actually made the amend. So now I'm standing at an AA podium. I've just told this big, major lie, and I can feel the sweat pouring down. And the guy asks, like, a follow-up question, so I elaborate on my lie a little bit. I had a girl I sponsored with me that night that had ridden down with me. We finished, all these people thanked me. We're in the car. I hope she wasn't talking about committing suicide because I didn't hear a word she said on the way home. I'm thinking about this. I get home and I say to my husband, Vince, who many of you knew, I said, oh my God, the most terrible thing happened at the meeting tonight. I tell him he's my husband. He loves me. I'm looking for some, you know, I tell him what I did and he goes, Jesus Christ, Pat, you better clean that up. Now it's like 11 o'clock at night. There's nothing I can do about it now, you know, so I don't sleep, obviously. So the next day I called JCPenney and I sit the store where I worked, and it was actually in Orange County, and I say, could I speak to the manager, please? And the woman says, may I ask who's calling? I said, well, my name will mean nothing, but whatever it was, 20 years ago, I worked for your store, and I stole some money when I make arrangements to pay it back. And she's like, one moment, please. Like, this happens all the time, you know. So now I get the store manager, and I give him my little, you know, I'm trying to make amends here, blah, blah, blah. How do I do that? And he said, well, you can just write a check for the amount. By the way, I had prayed about the amount. I don't know how much it was because it was a little here, a little there. I prayed on it, and I came up with a figure that seemed enough and then some, you know, that I was comfortable more than covered it. So I had told the guy this. And he said, well, just write a check for that amount and send it to me. Put a little note in there to remind me what this is for and send it to my attention. Okay, fine. So I did that and sent it off. I thought I'd get like a thank you note or something. Did not. But I thought, you know, I remember sending that check off thinking, whew, that's over. Yeah, not quite. Honestly, 6 months almost to the day after all of that, I get a call from the new secretary at the Under the Bridge meeting who wants to ask me to speak. So, okay, we pick a date. I write it in my book, and he says, you'll be speaking on step 9. And I said, oh, you know, actually, I didn't say it then. I wrote it, and I called him back, and I said, you know, I was just thinking, the last time I was there, I talked on step 9. You probably would rather hear me talk about something else. And he said, oh, no, we love to hear you talk about step 9. So I had to go to this meeting and stand up in front of these old-timers and say, you know, the last time I was here, I told this terrible lie at your podium. I was so humiliated, I can't even begin to tell you. But that's the day that I was free from it. You know, thanks a lot for reminding me of all that, Diane. You're just a great pal. You know, I've had a great life here. I've been sober a long time. I've had a great life here. And, you know, I mentioned my husband. We met in Alcoholics Anonymous, my former husband, that when I got sober, I was able to make amends to him. He passed away when I was 3 years sober, but I had 100% made my amends to him. And because of that, I was able to, I fell in love with Vince, and I was able to be, you know, a really good wife. I'm not trying to say I'm the greatest wife in the world, but I wouldn't have been any kind of a wife if I hadn't learned the tools there with my former husband, you know. And Vince and I had almost 30 really great years together, and he died a few years ago, and my heart kind of broke. It didn't kind of break, it broke. And I didn't, well, a couple of things. I didn't know you could feel that bad for so long, as long as I did, a couple of years, actually, and not just go crazy, but you can, apparently. And I must say this, never once did the thought of picking up a drink cross my mind, not once. And that's because I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. The night after he died, I was at my home group meeting. I mean, that's what we do. You know, where else would I be? I remember people saying, oh, I can't believe you're here. Where else would I be? Where else would I be except with you, you know? A couple of months after he died, I realized that that I had stopped praying. And it didn't happen that day. It had already happened. And I thought, oh, that's not good. I need to pray. But I couldn't. I just couldn't seem to make myself pray. And I'm not sure entirely why. I know part of it, at least, is because he and I used to pray together. And whatever. Anyway, I couldn't pray. So I shared about it in my women's meeting that night that I realized I was, you know, even though I was trying, I couldn't seem to do it. And a woman that meeting said to me, do you think you could make a commitment to this meeting that you would read the 24-hour day book or the daily reflections, whichever one it was at the time, that you would read that every day? I said, well, yeah, I could do that. And she said, why don't you just do that? And so I did that. I did that because I made a commitment in that meeting that I would do it. And eventually it led me back to prayer. I like to tell that story because I was, I guess, 33 years sober at the time. And And I'm glad that I didn't feel like I'm sober too long to ask for help. You know, if I'm thinking I'm sober too long to sit in a meeting that's got newcomers in it and ask for help, then I think I'm in a lot of trouble. You know, we're never sober too long to ask for help. After Vince died, I continued to work for a while, and then I remember thinking every day, gee, I wish I could afford to retire. I bet I said that every day for 2 years, and then one day I thought, I have no idea if I can afford to retire or not. So I went and met with a financial planner who said, absolutely, you can. And so I gave notice the next day, and actually gave them 6 months' notice. That job, this also reminded me, I had worked for my husband for years, and then he had a heart attack, and his business kind of went in the toilet. And somebody in AA said to me, "Do you need a? I heard you need a job." I said, "Yeah, I do." And she hired me. She was the HR person. She hired me at this law firm, which was in Pasadena, where we were living. And I didn't really want to do that. I didn't want to go back to being a legal secretary. But really, the only two things I'd ever done were legal secretary and go-go dancing. So. Legal secretary seemed like the best bet there. So I reluctantly went and I remember I started the job on the day of my 50th birthday and cried all the way to work. I felt so sorry for myself, but that's the job I retired from, you know. It's the job, and I loved that job. So I retired and I moved out to Palm Desert, and you know, I miss Vince every day. There's no question about it, but I have a great life. You know, my life, I have sad times for sure, but by and large, my life is happy. I'll just tell one other little thing and I'll sit down. My whole life, I've been kind of a couch potato. You know, Vince was always big on exercise, and he was always trying to encourage me to, you know, go to the gym or exercise, but I just never, you know, just not my thing. So now I'm retired and I started doing a little bit of hiking with a couple of girls out where I live, and more for the social aspect of it, really, than the exercise. But one day my friend Linda said to me, "Have you ever heard of the Camino de Santiago?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Go home and Google it and tell me what you think." So I went home and Googled it, and I called her up, and I said, "I am in." The Camino de Santiago, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is a spiritual pilgrimage in Spain. Actually, start in southern France. You cross the Pyrenees Mountains. It's a hike. You cross the Pyrenees Mountains, and then you walk all across northern Spain to the cathedral in Santiago. It's 500 miles. So I say to Linda, "I'm in, totally in." She said, "You know, you'll have to train." She's a big backpacker. She said, "You know, you'll have to train." I said, "Yeah, yeah." And she said, "I'll help you." I said, "Okay." So we start training. The first day we go out to train, we walk about 2 miles on a more or less flat surface. We get almost back to the car. We're maybe from here to the other side of the room from the car, and I cannot go another step, literally. I sit down on this rock. She's a big photographer as well, so she documented all this. I have this picture on my refrigerator. I'm hunched over on this rock, just weeping and saying, "I cannot make it to the car." And finally, I get to the car, and she's driving me home, and I said, "You're probably thinking you picked the wrong person to do this with." And she said, "Oh, you'll be fine. This is just your first day of training." She told me much later that she was thinking, "Oh, my God, she's never going to be able to do this." So, long story short, you know, I trained hard. I really trained hard, and lost a lot of weight, and you know, got in good shape, and off we went to Spain last September. I, Pat Yeo, hiked across the Pyrenees Mountains. Just want to say that it's our third day of hiking, and I had this moment. We'd hiked maybe 13 or 14 miles at this point of the day. It was getting towards the end of the day, and I had this spiritual experience. I said to her, "You know, I feel so good. I have never, oh, I can't even talk about this. I have never felt this good in my life." A few minutes later, I fell on my face. Still have numb teeth, actually, from this experience. And it ended the trip for me. When I came home, everybody said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You must be so disappointed your trip ended." You know, if I knew it was going to end the same way, I would do it again. Everybody hikes to Santiago for the spiritual experience. I had my spiritual experience. You know, it doesn't always come where you think it's going to come or look like you think it's going to look. You know, I had a fabulous time the time that I was there. I really don't feel like I got shortchanged at all. You know, my life is so full and so good. I get to do so many cool things that I never would have thought of doing. I would never have thought of doing anything like that. Last night I went to the gladiator fights. Do you even know what that is? I mean, these are like, it's like boxing, wrestling, kickboxing all in one. There's apparently no rules, except you can't choke somebody. I did this because one of the girls in my home group is, in fact, a champion, and we went to support her. And I'm sitting there, I mean, I can't even tell you, this is so outside my comfort zone, but I had the time of my life. Am I going to become a big fan? No, absolutely not. But I did it, you know, I did it and had a great time. If you're new, what I'm trying to tell you is I am living my life. You know, I'm 70 years old, I'm 39 years sober, I have the best life I have ever had. If you're new here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you stay. Thank you.
And that's how it works, by golly. And now Patty O from Mission Viejo.
I'm Patty, I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service center.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.